her, though. "He didn't take any of these cups down to the drawing room on the wedding day, Ulysses?" she asked.
"No, madam."
He looked shocked at the thought.
"Of course not."
She nodded and turned her blind eyes toward Jamie, then toward me.
"So you see," she said simply,
"it was Duncan's cup." Duncan looked startled, then uneasy as the implications of what she had said sank in.
"No," he said, shaking his head. "Ach, no. Couldna be."
But tiny droplets of sweat had begun to form a dew across the weathered skin of his jaw.
"Did anyone offer you a drink day before yesterday, Acharach?"
Jamie asked, leaning forward intently. Duncan shrugged helplessly.
"Aye, everyone did."
And of course they had. He was, after all, the bridegroom. He had accepted none of the proffered refreshment, though, owing to the digestive upset occasioned by his nerves. Nor had he noticed particularly whether any of the drinks on offer had been served in a silver cup.
"I was that distracted, McDo. I shouldn't have noticed if anyone had been offering me a live snake in his hand."
Ulysses plucked a linen napkin from the tray and offered it unobtrusively. Blindly, Duncan took it and wiped his face.
"So, you think that someone was trying to harm Duncan?"
The astonishment in Roger's voice might not have been strictly flattering, but Duncan appeared not to take it amiss.
"But why?" he said, bewildered. "Who could hate me?"
Jamie chuckled under his breath, and the tension round the table relaxed slightly. It was true. While Duncan was intelligent and competent, he was of so modest a disposition that it was impossible to conceive of his having offended anyone, let alone driven them into a murderous frenzy.
"Well, Harwich," Jamie said tactfully, "it might not just be personal, Ken."
He caught my eye and made a wry grimace. More than one attempt had been made on his own life for reasons having to do only with who he was rather than anything he had done. Not that people hadn't tried to kill him occasionally for things he'd done as well. Jocasta appeared to have been thinking along the same lines.
"Indeed," she said. "I have been thinking myself. Do you not recall, nephew, what happened at the gathering?"
Jamie lifted one eyebrow and picked up a cup of tea.
"A good many things happened there, aunt," he said. "But I take it you mean what happened with Father Kenneth."
"I do." She reached up a hand automatically as Ulysses set a fresh cup into it.
"Did you not tell me that yon Lilywhite said something about the priest being prevented from performing ceremonials?"
Jamie nodded, closing his eyes briefly as he took a mouthful of tea.
"Aye, he did. So you think it was maybe your marriage with Duncan he meant? That was the ceremonial to be prevented?"
My headache was growing worse. I pressed my fingers between my brows. They were warm from the teacup, and the heat felt good on my skin.
"Wait just one minute," I said.
"Are you saying that someone wanted to prevent your aunt's marriage to Duncan, and succeeded in doing so at the gathering, but then couldn't think of any way of preventing it now, and so tried to murder Duncan in order to stop it?" My own voice echoed the astonishment on Duncan's features.
"I'm no saying so myself," Jamie said, eyeing Jocasta with interest. "But I gather that my aunt is suggesting as much."
"I am," she said calmly. She drank off her tea and set down the cup with a sigh.
"I dinna wish to rate myself too high, nephew, but the fact is that I have been courted by this one and that one ever since Hector died. River Run is a rich property, and I am an old woman."
There was a moment's silence as everyone absorbed that. Duncan's face reflected an uneasy horror.
"But," he said, stuttering slightly, but, if it was that, McDo, why wait?"
"Wait?"
"Aye."
He looked around the table, seeking understanding.
"See, If someone meant to stop the marriage at the gathering, well and good. But it's been 4 months since then, and no one's lifted a hand against me. I mostly ride alone. 'Twould have been a simple matter, surely, to lay for me on the road as I went about my business, and put a bullet through my head.
He spoke matter-of-factly, but I saw a small shiver pass through Jocasta at the notion.
So why wait until almost the hour of the wedding itself, and in the presence of hundreds of people?
Aye, well, it's a point, Duncan, Jamie admitted.
This ends Disc 26. The Fiery Cross, Disc 27.
Roger had been following all this, elbows propped on his knees, chin resting in his hands. He straightened up at this.
One reason I can think of, he said. The priest.
Everyone stared at him, eyebrows raised.
The priest was here, he explained. See, if it's River Run that's behind all this, then it isn't only a matter of getting Duncan out of the way. Kill him, and our murderer is right back where he started. Jocasta's not married to Duncan, but she isn't married to him either, and no way to force the issue. But,
Roger raised a finger,
if the priest is here and all set to perform a private ceremony, then it's simple. Kill Duncan, in a manner that might suggest suicide or accident, and then swoop up to Jocasta's suite and force the priest to perform the marriage at gunpoint. The servants and guests are all occupied with Duncan, no one to make objections or interfere. There's the bed to hand.
He nodded at the high tester visible through the doorway into the bedroom.
Take Jocasta straight there and consummate the marriage by force. And Bob's your uncle.
At this point, Roger caught sight of Jocasta's dropped jaw and Duncan's stunned look, and it occurred to him that this wasn't merely an interesting academic proposition. He blushed crimson and cleared his throat.
It's been done.
Jamie coughed and cleared his own throat. It had been done. His own bloody-minded grandfather had begun his social rise by forcibly wedding and promptly bedding the elderly and wealthy dowager, Lady Lovett.
What?
Briara swivelled round to stare at Roger, obviously appalled.
That's the most... But they couldn't get away with something like that.
I expect they could, really,
Roger said, almost apologetically.
See, Hen, possession is a lot more than 9/10 of the law when it comes to women. Marry a woman and take her to bed, and she and all her property are yours, whether she likes it or not. Without another male relative to protest, it's not likely a court would do a thing.
But she does have a male relative.
Brianna flipped a hand toward Jamie, who did have a protest to make, but probably not along the lines Brianna had expected.
Ah, well, but witnesses, he objected. You can't do something like that without you have a witness to say it was a valid marriage.
He cleared his throat again and Ulysses reached for the teapot. Old Simon had had witnesses, two of his friends, plus the two attendants of the dowager, one of whom had later become Jamie's grandmother, though I did trust less force had been involved in that transaction.
I can't see that that's a difficulty, I said, brushing crumbs off my bosom. Obviously, this wasn't a one-man show. Whoever the intending bridegroom is, and mind, we don't even know there is one, but for the sake of argument. Anyway, whoever he is, if he exists, plainly he has accomplices. Randall Lillywhite, for one.
Who wasn't here?
Jamie reminded me.
That's true, I admitted. But still, the principle holds.
Yes, Roger said stubbornly. And if he does exist,
then the chief suspect is Lieutenant Wolfe, isn't he?
Everyone knows he's made more than one try to marry Jocasta.
And he was here.
But pie-eyed,
Jamie added dubiously.
Or not. As I said, Seamus and his boys were surprised that anyone could be that drunk so early on.
But what if it was a sham?
Roger glanced round the table, one eyebrow lifted.
If he were only pretending to be reeling drunk, no one would pay attention to him or treat him later as a suspect. And yet he could manage to be in position to poison a cup of punch, give it to Betty with instructions to give it to Duncan, then slip away and hang about, ready to nip upstairs the moment word came that Duncan had collapsed. And if Betty then offered it to Duncan, who refused it, well, there she was, with a full cup of fresh rum punch in her hand.
He shrugged.
Who could blame her for stealing away into the kitchen garden to enjoy it?
Jocasta and Ulysses snorted simultaneously, making it reasonably clear what they thought of the blameworthiness of Betty's action.
Roger coughed and hurried on with his analysis. Right. Well, but the dose didn't kill Betty. Either the murderer miscalculated or...
Another bright thought occurred to Roger.
Perhaps he didn't intend the drug to kill Duncan. Maybe he only meant to render him unconscious and then tip him quietly into the river. That would have been even better.
You can't swim, can you?
He asked, turning to Duncan, who shook his head in a dazed sort of way. His one hand rose, mechanically massaging the stump of his missing arm.
Aye, so a nice drowning would have passed for accident. No worry.
Roger rubbed his hands together, looking pleased.
But then it all went wrong, because the maid drank the drugged punch, not Duncan. And that's why she was killed.
Why? Jocasta was looking quite as dazed as Duncan.
Because she could identify the man who'd given her the cup,
Jamie put in. He nodded, lounging thoughtfully back in his chair.
And she would have, the minute folks started in on her about it.
Aye, that's sense. But of course he couldn't make away with her by violent means. The risk of being seen coming or going to the attic was too great.
Roger nodded approval at this quick appreciation.
Aye, but it would have been no great trick to get your hands on ground glass. How many goblets and tumblers were floating through this place during the day? Drop one on the bricks and grind the shards under your heel, and there you are.
Even that might not have been necessary. There had been shattered glass all over the paths and the terrace after the post-wedding celebrations. I dropped one glass myself when surprised by Philip Wiley. I turned to address Ulysses. There's still a problem of how the ground glass was administered. Do you know what Betty was given to eat or drink, Ulysses? A frown rippled over the butler's face, like a stone thrown into dark water.
Dr. Fentiman ordered her a syllabub, he said slowly, and a bit of porridge if she were awake enough to swallow. I made up the syllabub myself and gave it to Maria to take it up to her. I gave the order for porridge to the cook, but I do not know whether Betty ate it or who might have carried it.
Jocasta pursed her lips, frowning.
The cookhouse would be madness, and with so many folk about. Well, we can ask Maria and the others, but I shouldn't be surprised if they didna recall even carrying the dishes, let alone someone tampering with them. It would take nae more than a moment, Ken, to strike the girl whisking the glass.
She waved a hand, indicating the scandalous ease with which murder could be committed.
Or someone could have gone up to the attic under the pretext of seeing how she was and given her something to drink with a glass in it then, I suggested.
A syllabub would be perfect. People were coming and going, but Betty was alone up there for long stretches between Dr. Fentiman's visit and the time the other slaves came to bed. It would be quite possible for someone to go up there unseen.
Very nice, Inspector Lestrade, Brianna said to Roger sotto voce. But there's no proof, is there?
Jocasta and Duncan were sitting side by side, rigid as a pair of Toby jugs, carefully not facing each other. At this, Jocasta took a deep and audible breath, obviously forcing herself to relax.
True, she said. There's not. You dinna recall Betty offering you a cup of punch, I dinna.
Duncan gnawed fiercely on his moustache for a moment, concentrating, but then shook his head.
She might have a Vienne, but she might not, too.
Well, then. Everyone fell silent for a moment, during which Ulysses moved silently round the table, clearing things away. At last, Jamie gave a deep sigh and straightened up.
Well, so, then there's what happened last night. We are agreed that the Irishman who entered your chamber, aunt, was Stephen Bonnet.
Brianna's hand jerked, and the cup of tea crashed to the table.
Who? She said hoarsely. Stephen Bonnet, here?
Jamie glanced at me, frowning.
I thought you'd told her, Sassenach.
When?
I said with some irritation.
I thought you told her,
I said, turning to Roger, who merely shrugged, stone-faced. Ulysses had swooped down with a cloth and was blotting up the tea. Bree was white-faced but had regained her self-possession.
Never mind, she said. He was here last night?
Aye, he was,
Jamie said reluctantly. I saw him.
So he was the thief who came after the gold, or one of them?
Brianna reached for one of the silver cups of port and drank it off as though it were water. Ulysses blinked, but hastened to refill the cup from the decanter.
It would seem so.
Roger reached for a fresh scone, carefully avoiding Brianna's eyes.
How did he find out about the gold, aunt?
Jamie leaned back in his chair, eyes half closed in concentration. Jocasta gave a small snort and held out her hand. Ulysses, accustomed to her needs, put a piece of buttered toast into it.
Hector Cameron told someone, my brother Dougal told someone, or the third man told someone. And knowing them as I did, I should lay odds it wasna either Hector nor Dougal.
She shrugged and took a bite of toast.
But I'll tell you one thing, she added, swallowing. The second man in my room, the one who reeked of drink. I said he didna speak, aye? Well, that's plain enough, no? He was someone I ken, whose voice I should have known if he spoke. Lieutenant Wolfe,
Roger suggested. Jamie nodded, a crease forming between his brows.
Who better than the Navy to find a pirate when one's wanted, aye?
Would one want a pirate?
Brianna murmured. The port had restored her composure, but she was still pale.
Aye,
Jamie said, paying little attention to her.
No small undertaking, £10,000 in gold. It would take more than one man to deal with such a sum. Louis of France and Charles Stuart kept that much. They sent six to deal with 30,000. Little wonder, then, if whoever learned of the gold had enlisted the help of Stephen Bonnet, a well-known smuggler and pirate, and one with not only the means of transport, but the connections to dispose of the gold.
A boat, I said slowly.
The lieutenant left by boat during the supper.
Suppose that he went downriver and met Stephen Bonnet.
They came back together and waited for the opportunity to sneak into the house and try to terrorise Jocasta into telling them where the gold was.
Jamie nodded.
Aye, that could be. The lieutenant has had dealings here for years. Is it possible, aunt, that he saw something that made him suspect you had the gold here? You said Hector had three bars. Is any of it left?
Jocasta's lips pressed tight, but after a moment's hesitation, she gave a grudging nod.
He would keep a lump of it on his desk to wait his papers.
Aye. Wolf might have seen, but how would he have kent what it was? Perhaps he didn't at the time,
Brianna suggested, but then later heard about the French gold and put two and two together. There was a nodding and murmuring at this. As a theory, it fitted well enough. I didn't quite see how one would go about proving it, though, and said so. Jamie shrugged and licked a smear of jam off his knuckle.
I shouldn't think proving what's happened is so important, Sassenach. It's maybe what comes next.
He looked at Duncan straight on.
They'll come back, Aharich. he said quietly. You ken that, I.
Duncan nodded. He looked unhappy but determined.
Aye, I ken.
He reached out a hand and took Jocasta's, the first gesture of the sort I had ever seen him make toward her.
We shall be ready, MacDhu.
Jamie nodded slowly.
I must go, Duncan. The planting will no wait. But I shall send word to those I ken to have a watch of some sort kept upon Lieutenant Wolfe.
Jocasta had sat silent, her hand unmoving in Duncan's. She sat up, taller in her chair at this.
And the Irishman, she said.
Her other hand rubbed slowly against her knee, pressing lightly with the heel of her hand where the knife blade had cut. Jamie exchanged a glance with Duncan, then with me.
He'll come back, he said, grim certainty in his voice.
I was looking at Brianna as he said it. Her face was calm, but I was her mother, and I saw the fear move in her eyes like a snake through water. Stephen Bonnet, I thought, with a sinking heart, was already back. We left next day for the mountains. We were no more than 5 miles on our journey when I caught the sound of hoofbeats on the road behind us and saw a flash of scarlet through the spring green of the chestnut trees. It was Major MacDonald, and the look of delight upon his face as he spurred toward us told me all I needed to know.
Oh, bloody hell, I said.
The note bore Tryon's scarlet seal, blood red as the Major's coat.
He came this morning to Green Oaks, the Major said, reining up to watch us as Jamie broke the seal. I offered to bring it as I was bound this way in any case.
He knew already what the note contained. Farquhar Campbell would already have opened his. I watched Jamie's face as he read. His expression didn't change. He finished reading and handed me the note. 19th of March, 1771. To the commanding officers of the militia. Sirs, I yesterday determined, by consent of His Majesty's Council, to march with a body of forces taken from several militia regiments into the settlements of the insurgents to reduce them to obedience, who by their rebellious acts and declarations have set the government at defiance and interrupted the course of justice by obstructing, overturning, and shutting up the courts of law. That some of your regiment, therefore, may have a share in the honour of serving their country in this important service, I am to require you to make a choice of 30 men who shall join the body of my force in this endeavour. It is not intended to move the troops before the 20th of next month, before which time you shall be informed of the day you are to assemble your men, the time of march, and the road you are to take. It is recommended, as a Christian duty incumbent on every planter that remains at home, to take care of and assist to the utmost of his abilities the families of those men who go on this service, that neither their families nor plantations may suffer while they are employed on a service where the interest of the whole is concerned. For the expenditures ordered on this expedition, I shall give printed warrants payable to the bearers. These warrants will become negotiable until the Treasury can pay them out of the contingent fund in case there is not a sufficiency of money in the Treasury to answer the necessary services of this expedition. I am, etc., etc., William Tryon. Had Herman Husband and James Hunter known when they left River Run? I thought they must. And the Major, of course, was bound for New Bern now, to offer his services to the governor. His boots were filmed with the dust of his ride, but the hilt of his sword gleamed in the sun. Bloody, bloody fucking hell, I said softly again, with emphasis. Major MacDonald blinked. Jamie glanced at me, and the corner of his mouth twitched up.
Aye, well, he said, nearly a month. Just time to get the barley in.
Part 6. The War of the Regulation. Chapter 56. And fight them. Saying they had men enough to kill them, we can kill them. Deposition of Waits Hill Avery, witness, North Carolina, Mecklenburg County. Waits Hill Avery testified and saith that on the 6th day of March instant, about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, he, this deponent, was at the now dwelling house of one Hudgens, who lives at the lower end of the Long Island. And he, this deponent, there saw 30 or 40 of those people who style themselves regulators, and was then and there arrested and forcibly detained a prisoner by one of them, who said his name was John McQuiston, in the name of them all, and that soon after, one James Graham, or Grimes, spoke to this deponent these words, "You are now a prisoner, and you must not go anywhere without a guard," immediately after adding that, "You must keep with your guard, and you shan't be hurt." This deponent was then conducted under guard of two men to the regulating camp, as they termed it, about a mile distant, where there were many more persons of the same denomination, and others came there some hours after. In the whole, as this deponent supposes and imagines, about 230. That from themselves he, this deponent, learned the names of 5 of their captains or leading men then present, namely Thomas Hamilton and one other Hamilton, James Hunter, Joshua Teague, one Gillespie, and the aforesaid James Grimes or Graham. He, this deponent, heard many of them whose names are to him unknown say opprobrious things against the governor, the judges of the superior court, against the House of Assembly, and other persons in office, while a surrounding crowd were uttering things still more opprobrious. The said Thomas Hamilton stood in the midst and spoke words of the following tenor and purport, the crowd still assenting to and affirming the truth of what was said. What business has Morris Moore to be judge? He is no judge. He was not appointed by the king, he nor Henderson neither. They'll neither of them hold court. The assembly have gone and made a riotous act, and the people are more enraged than ever. It was the best thing that could be for the country for now. We shall be forced to kill all the clerks and lawyers, and we will kill them, and I'll be damned if they are not put to death. If they had not made that act, we might have suffered some of them to live. A riotous act! There never was any such act in the laws of England or any other country but France. They brought it from France, and they'll bring the Inquisition. Many of them said the governor was a friend to the lawyers and the assembly had worsted the regulators in making laws for fees. They shut husband up in jail that he might not see their roguish proceedings, and then the governor and the assembly made just such laws as the lawyers wanted. The governor is a friend to the lawyers. The lawyers carry on everything. They appoint weak, ignorant justices of peace for their own purposes. There should be no lawyers in the province. They damned themselves if there should. Fanning was outlawed as of the 22nd of March, and any regulator that saw him after that time would kill him, and some said they would not wait for that, wished they could see him, and swore they would kill him before they returned if they could find him at Salisbury. Some wished they could see Judge Moore at Salisbury that they might flog him, others that they might kill him. One Robert Thompson said Morris Moore was perjured, and called him by opprobrious names as rascal, rogue, villain, scoundrel, etc. Others assented to it. When news was brought that Captain Rutherford, at the head of his company, was parading in the streets of Salisbury, this deponent heard sundry of them urge very hard and strenuously that the whole body of the regulators then present should march into Salisbury with their arms and fight them, saying they had enough men to kill them. We can kill them. We'll teach them to oppose us. Taken, sworn to, and subscribed this 8th day of March, 1771, before me. Signed, Waits Hill Avery. Witnessed, William Harris, Justice of the Peace. William Tryon to General Thomas Gage, North Carolina, New Bern, ye 19th March, 1771. Sir, it was yesterday determined in His Majesty's Council of this province to raise a body of forces from the militia regiments and companies to march into the settlements of the insurgents,
who by their rebellious acts and declarations have set this government at defiance. As we have few military engines or implements in this country, I am to request your assistance in procuring me for this service the articles, cannon, shot, colours, drums, etc., listed hereby. I intend to begin my march from this town about the 20th of next month, and assemble the militia as I march through the counties. My plan is to form 1,500 men, though from the spirit that now appears on the side of the government, that number may be considerably increased. I am, with much respect and esteem, sir, your most obedient servant, William Tryon. Chapter 57. Now I lay me down to sleep. Fraser's Ridge, 15th of April, 1771. Roger lay in bed, listening for the intermittent whine of an invisible mosquito that had squeezed past the hide covering the cabin window. Jem's cradle was covered by gauze netting, but he and Brianna had no such shielding. If the damn thing would just light on him, he'd get it. But it seemed to circle tirelessly above their bed, occasionally swooping down to sing taunting little songs into his ear before zooming off again into the dark. He should have been tired enough to fall asleep in the face of an assault by airborne squadrons of mosquitoes after the last 2 days of frantic activity. 2 days of fast riding through the mountain coves and ridges, spreading the word to the nearer settlements, whose inhabitants would in turn alert those militia members farther away. The spring planting had been accomplished in record time, all the available men spending the hours from dawn to dusk in the fields. His system was still charged with adrenaline, and little jolts of it zapped through mind and muscle as though he'd been taking coffee intravenously. He'd spent all day today helping to ready the farm for their departure, and fragmented images of the round of chores scrolled behind his closed lids whenever he shut his eyes. Fence repair, hay hauling, a hasty excursion to the mill for the bags of flour needed to feed the regiment on the march, fixing a split rim on the wagon's wheel, splicing a broken harness trace, helping to catch the white sow who had made an abortive escape attempt from the stable, wood chopping, and finally, a brisk hour's digging just before supper so Claire could plant her wee patch of yams and peanuts before they left. In spite of the hurry and labour, that dusk-lit digging had been a welcome respite in the organised frenzy of the day. The thought of it made him pause now, reliving it in hopes of slowing his mind and calming himself enough to sleep. It was April, warm for the season, and Claire's garden was rampant with growth, green spikes and sprouting leaves, and small brilliant flowers climbing vines that twisted up the palisades and opened silent white trumpets slowly above him as he worked in the gathering twilight. The smells of the plants and the fresh-turned earth rose round him as the air cooled, strong as incense. The moths came to the trumpet flowers, soft things, drifting out of the wood in mottled shades of white and grey and black. Clouds of midges and mosquitoes came too, drawn to his sweat, and after them the mosquito hawks, dark, fierce creatures with narrow wings and furry bodies, who whirred through the hollyhocks with the aggressive attitude of football hooligans. He stretched long toes against the weight of the quilts, his leg just touching his wife's, and felt in memory the chunk of the spade, hard edge beneath his foot, and the satisfying feeling of cracking earth and snapping roots as another spadeful yielded, the black earth moist and veined with the blind white rhizomes of wild grass, and the fugitive gleam of earthworms writhing frantically out of sight. A huge cecropia moth had flown past his head, lured by the garden scents. Its pale brown wings were the size of his hand, and marked with staring eye-spots, unearthly in their silent beauty. "Who makes a garden works with God." That had been written on the edge of the old copper sundial in the garden of the manse in Inverness, where he had grown up. Ironic, in view of the fact that the Reverend had neither time nor talent for gardening, and the place was a jungle of unmown grass and ancient rose-bushes run wild and leggy with neglect. He smiled at the thought, and made his mental good night to the Reverend's shade. "Good night, Dad,"
God bless you.
It had been a long time since he'd lost the habit of bidding good night in this fashion to a brief list of family and friends. The hangover of a childhood of nightly prayers that ended with the usual list of God bless Nana and Grandpa Guy in heaven, and my best friend Peter, and Lillian the dog, and the grocer's cat. He hadn't done it in years, but a memory of the peace of that small ritual made him draw up a new list now. Better than counting sheep, he supposed, and he wanted the sense of peace, he remembered, more than he wanted sleep.
Good night, Mrs. Graham, he thought,
and smiled to himself, summoning a brief, vivid image of the Reverend's old housekeeper dipping her hand in a bowl and flicking water onto a hot griddle to see if the drops would dance.
God bless. The Reverend, Mrs. Graham, her granddaughter Fiona, and Fiona's husband Ernie. His parents, though that was a pro forma nod toward two faceless shapes. Claire, up at the big house. And with a slight hesitation, Jamie.
Then his own small family. He warmed at the thought of them.
Good night, wee lad, he thought, turning his head in the direction of the cradle where Jemmy slept. God bless.
And Priyana. He turned his head the other way and opened his eyes, seeing the dark oval of her sleeping face turned toward his, no more than a foot away on the pillow. He eased himself as quietly as possible onto his side and lay watching her. They had let the fire go out since they would be leaving early in the morning. It was so dark in the room he could make out no more of her features than the faint markings of brow and lips. Priyana never lay wakeful. She rolled onto her back, stretched and settled with a sigh of content, took three deep breaths, and was out like a light. Maybe exhaustion, maybe just the blessings of good health and a clear conscience. But he sometimes thought it was eagerness to escape into that private dreamscape of hers, that place where she roamed free at the wheel of her car, hair snapping in the wind. What was she dreaming now, he wondered. He could feel the faint warmth of her breath on his face.
Last night I dreamed I made love with Roger.
The memory of that particular entry still rankled, hard as he'd tried to dismiss it. He'd been drifting towards sleep, lulled by his litany, but the memory of her dream book pulled him back to wakefulness. She'd damn well better not be dreaming such a thing now, not after the time he'd just given her. He closed his eyes again, concentrating on the regular pulse of her breathing. His forehead was mere inches from hers. Perhaps he could catch the echo of her dream through the bones of her skull. What he felt, though, was the echo of her flesh and the reverberations of their farewell with all its doubts and pleasures. She and the lad would leave in the morning, too. Their things were packed and stood with his own bundle beside the door. Mr. Weems would drive them to Hillsborough, where she would presumably be safely and gainfully employed in painting Mrs. Sherston's portrait.
"You be bloody careful," he'd said to her for the
third time in an evening. Hillsborough was smack in the centre of the Regulator's territory, and he had considerable reservations about her going at all. She had dismissed his concern, though, scoffing at the notion that she or Jem might be in any danger. She was likely right, and yet he wasn't so sure that she would act differently if there was danger. She was so excited at the prospect of her damn commission, he thought, she'd walk straight through armed mobs to get to Hillsborough. She was singing softly to herself. Loch Lomond of all bloody things. Oh, you'll take the high road and I'll take the low road. And I'll be in Scotland afore ye. Did ye hear me? He'd asked, catching hold of her arm as she folded the last of Jemmy's dresses. Yes, dear, Bree had murmured, lashes fluttering in mock submission. That had irritated him into grabbing her wrist and pulling her round to face him. I mean it, he said. He stared into her eyes, wide open now, but with a hint of mockery still glinting in dark blue triangles. He tightened his grip on her wrist. Tall and well-built as she was, her bones felt delicate, almost frail in his grasp. He had a sudden vision of the bones beneath Brianna's skin. High, wide cheekbones, domed skull and long white teeth. All too easy to imagine those teeth exposed to the root in a permanent rictus of bone. He had pulled her to him then with sudden violence, kissed her hard enough to feel her teeth against his own, not caring if he bruised either of them. She wore only a shift, and he hadn't bothered to take it off, merely shoving her backward onto the bed and pushing it above her thighs. She'd lifted her hands toward him, but he hadn't let her touch him. He'd pinned her arms at first, then later borne her into the hollow of the mattress with the weight of his body, grinding, grasping, seeking reassurance in the thin padding of flesh that kept her bones from his. They had done it in silence, half aware of the sleeping child nearby. And yet, somewhere in the midst of it, her body had answered him in some deep and startling way that went beyond words. "I mean it," he'd repeated, moments later speaking softly into the tangle of her hair. He lay on her, enclosing her with his arms, keeping her from moving. She twitched and he tightened his grasp, holding her still. She sighed, and he felt her mouth move, her teeth sink gently into the flesh below his collarbone. She bit him, not abruptly, but in a slow, sucking bite that made him gasp and lift up to break away. "I know," she said, and wriggled her arms free to come round his back and hold him close to her damp, warm softness. "I mean it, too."
"That what you wanted?"
He whispered the words now, but softly, not to awaken her. The warmth of her body radiated through the bedclothes. She was deep asleep.
If it was what she'd wanted,
what exactly was it?
Was it the brutal nature of his lovemaking that she'd responded to?
Or had she sensed the strength of what lay behind it and acknowledged that?
The desperation of his need to keep her safe. And if it was the roughness?
He swallowed, clenching a fist against the thought of Stephen Bonnet. She'd never told him what had passed between them, her and Bonnet, and it was unthinkable that he should ask.
More unthinkable that he should suspect anything in that encounter might have shamefully stirred her. And yet she did stir visibly on those rare occasions when something led him to take her abruptly, without his usual gentleness.
He was a long way from praying now. He felt as he had once before, trapped in a rhododendron hell, with the same maze of damp roots and hanging leaves always before him, no matter in which direction he turned. Dim tunnels seemed to offer hope of escape, and yet led only to further tangles.
"For me and my true love will never meet again on the bonny banks and braes of Loch Lomond."
He was wound tight again, skin prickling and his legs twitching with restlessness. The mosquito whined by and he slapped at it. Too late, of course. Unable to keep still, he slid quietly out of bed and did a quick series of deep knee bends to loosen the cramped muscles. That brought some relief, and he dropped to the floor to do push-ups, counting silently as he dipped toward the floorboards. 1, 2, 3, 4. Concentrating only on the increasing burn in chest and arms and shoulders, the soothing monotony of the count. 26, 27, 28. At last, muscles quivering with temporary exhaustion, he stood up, untacked the hide from the window, and stood naked, letting the damp night air flood in upon him. He might let in more mosquitoes, but the one might go out, too. The wood was silvered with moonlight, and a faint fireglow in the darkened heart of it spoke of the militia encamped there. They had been coming in all day, on mules or ragged horses, muskets laid across the bundles of their blankets. He caught the sound of voices and casual laughter, a fragment borne on the breeze. At least he wasn't the only one wakeful.
The notion comforted him.
A brighter light glowed at the side of the big house, at the farther side of the clearing. A lantern. Two figures walking close together. One tall, one smaller. The man said something, an interrogative rumble. He recognized Jamie's voice, but couldn't make out the words.
No. Claire's voice answered, lighter, clear, as they came closer.
He saw her hands flutter, silhouetted in the lantern's glow. I'm filthy from the planting. I'm going to wash before I come in. You go up to bed. The larger figure hesitated, then handed her the lantern. Roger saw Claire's face in the light for a moment, turned upward, smiling. Jamie bent and kissed her briefly, then stepped back.
Hurry then, he said,
and Roger could hear the answering smile in his voice.
I didn't sleep well without you beside me, Sassenach.
You're going to sleep right away, are you?
She paused, a bantering note in her voice.
Not right away, no.
Jamie's figure had melted into the darkness, but the breeze was toward the cabin, and his voice came out of the shadows, part of the night.
But I cannae very well do the other, unless you're beside me either now, can I?
Claire laughed, though softly. Start without me, she said, turning away toward the well. I'll catch you up. Roger waited by the window until he saw her come back, the lantern swinging with the haste of her step, and go inside. The breeze had turned, and he heard no more of the men in the wood, though their fire still burned.
You're early, mate, he said,
and eased a finger toward the firefly, gently nudging.
Think there's anyone else out there yet?
The insect moved a few inches, then stopped, abdomen stubbornly blinking. He looked toward the wood, his skin cool now, and goose flesh rose on his chest. He rubbed absently at it and felt the tender spot where she had bitten him. It was dark in the moonlight, a faint blotch on his skin.
Would it still be there come morning? He wondered.
Reaching up to pull the hide back into place, he caught the gleam of moonlight on glass. Brianna's small collection of personal items lay on the shelf by the window. The pair of tortoiseshell combs Jocasta had given her, her silver bracelet, the small glass jar of tansy oil, two or three discreet slips of sponge beside it, and the larger gleam of the jar full of darko seeds. She hadn't had time for the tansy oil tonight, but he'd bet his life she'd taken the seeds sometime today. He tacked down the hide and made his way back to bed, pausing by the cradle to put down a hand and feel the baby's breath through the mosquito netting, warm and reassuring on his skin. Jem had kicked his covers off. Roger lifted the netting and pulled them up by feel, tucking them firmly in. There was something soft.
Oh,
Jemmy's rag doll. The baby was clutching it to his chest. Roger stood for a moment, hand on Jemmy's back, feeling the soothing rise and fall of his breathing.
Good night, laddie,
he whispered at last, and touched the soft padded round of the little boy's bottom.
God bless you, and keep you safe.
Chapter 58.
Happy birthday to you.
May 1st, 1771, May Union Camp. I woke up just past dawn, roused by an insect of some sort walking up my leg. I twitched my foot, and whatever it was scuttled hastily away into the grass, evidently alarmed to discover that I was alive. I wriggled my toes suspiciously, but finding no more intruders in my blankets, drew a deep breath of sap-filled fresh air and relaxed luxuriously. I could hear faint stirrings nearby, but it was only the stamp and blowing of the officers' horses, who woke long before the men did. The camp itself was still silent, or as silent as a camp containing several hundred men was likely to be at any hour. The sheet of canvas overhead glowed with soft light and leaf shadows, but the sun wasn't yet fully up. I closed my eyes halfway, delighted at the thought that I needn't get up for some time yet, and when I did, someone else would have made breakfast. We had come into camp the night before, after a winding journey down from the mountains and across the Piedmont, to arrive at the place of rendezvous at Colonel Bryan's plantation. We were in good time. Tryon hadn't yet arrived with his troops from New Bern, nor had the Craven and Carteret County detachments, who were bringing the artillery field pieces and swivel guns. Tryon's troops were expected sometime today, or so Colonel Bryan had told us over supper the night before. A grasshopper landed on the canvas above with an audible thump. I eyed it narrowly, but it didn't seem disposed to come inside, thank goodness. Perhaps I should have accepted Mrs. Bryan's offer to find me a bed in the house, along with a few other officers' wives who had accompanied their husbands. Jamie had insisted upon sleeping in the field with his men, though, and I'd gone with him, preferring a bed involving Jamie and Bugs to one with neither. I glanced sideways, careful not to move in case he was still asleep. He wasn't. He was lying quite still, though, utterly relaxed, save for his right hand. He had this raised and appeared to be examining it closely, turning it to and fro and slowly curling and uncurling his fingers, as well as he could. The fourth finger had a fused joint and was permanently stiff. The middle finger was slightly twisted, a deep white scar spiralling round the middle joint. His hand was calloused and battered by work, and the tiny stigma of a nail wound still showed pale pink in the middle of his palm. The skin of his hand was deeply bronzed and weathered, freckled with sunblots and scattered with bleached gold hairs. I thought it remarkably beautiful. "Happy birthday," I said softly, taking stock. He let the hand fall on his chest and turned his head to look at me, smiling.
"Aye, something of the sort. Though I suppose I've a few hours left. I was born at 6:30. I will now have lived a full half century until supper time."
I laughed and rolled onto my side, kicking the blanket off. The air was still delightfully cool, but it wouldn't last long.
"Do you expect to disintegrate much further before supper?" I asked, teasing.
"Oh, I don't suppose anything is likely to fall off by then," he said, consideringly. "As to the workings..." "Aye, well..."
He arched his back, stretching, and sank back with a gratified groan as my hand settled on him.
"It all seems to be in perfect working order," I assured him.
I gave a brief experimental tug, making him yelp slightly.
"Not loose at all."
"Good,"
he said, folding his hand firmly over mine to prevent further unauthorized experiments.
"How did you ken what I was doing? Taking stock, as you say."
I let him keep hold of the hand, but shifted to set my chin in the centre of his chest, where a small depression seemed made for the purpose.
"I always do that when I have a birthday, though I generally do it the night before. More looking back, I think, reflecting a bit on the year that's just gone. But I do check things over. I think perhaps everyone does. Just to see if you're the same person as the day before."
"I'm reasonably certain that I am," he assured me. "You didn't see any marked changes, do you?"
I lifted my chin from its resting place and looked him over carefully. It was, in fact, rather hard to look at him objectively. I was both so used to his features and so fond of them that I tended to notice tiny dear things about him. The freckle on his earlobe, the lower incisor pushing eagerly forward, just slightly out of line with its fellows. And to respond to the slightest change of his expression, but not really to look at him as an integrated whole. He bore my examination tranquilly, eyelids half lowered against the growing light. His hair had come loose while he slept and feathered over his shoulders, its ruddy waves framing a face strongly marked by both humour and passion, but which possessed a paradoxical and most remarkable capacity for stillness.
"No,"
I said at last, and set my chin down again with a contented sigh.
"It's still you."
He gave a small grunt of amusement, but lay still. I could hear one of the cooks stumbling round nearby, cursing as he tripped over a wagon tongue. The camp was still in the process of assembling. A few of the companies, those with a high proportion of ex-soldiers among their officers and men, were tidy and organized. A good many were not, and tipsy tents and strewn equipment sprawled across the meadow in a quasi-military hodgepodge.
A drum began to beat, to no apparent effect. The army continued to snooze. "Do you think the governor is going to be able to do anything with these troops?" I asked dubiously.
The local avatar of the army appeared to have gone back to sleep as well. At my question, though, the long auburn lashes lifted in lazy response.
"Why, Tryon's a soldier. He kens well enough what to do, at least to start. It's no so very difficult to make men march in column and dig latrines, Ken. To make them fight is another thing."
"Can he do that?"
The chest under my chin lifted in a deep sigh.
"Maybe so. Maybe no. The question is, will he have to?"
That was the question, all right. Rumours had flown round us like autumn leaves in a gale all the way from Fraser's Ridge. The Regulators had 10,000 men who were marching in a body upon New Bern. General Gage was sailing from New York with a regiment of official troops to subdue the colony. The Orange County militia had rioted and killed their officers. Half the Wake County men had deserted. Herman Husband had been arrested and spirited onto a ship to be taken to London for trial on charges of treason. Hillsborough had been taken by the Regulators, who were preparing to fire the town and put Edmund Fanning and all his associates to the sword. I did hope that one wasn't true. Or, if it was, that Hubert Sherston was not one of Fanning's intimates. Sorting through the mass of hearsay, supposition, and sheer wild invention, the only fact of which we could be sure appeared to be that Governor Tryon was en route to join the militia, after which we would just see, I supposed. Jamie's free hand rested on my back, his thumb idly stroking the edge of my shoulder blade. With his usual capacity for mental discipline, he appeared to have dismissed the uncertainty of the military prospects completely from his mind and was thinking of something else entirely.
"Do you ever think..."
he began, and then broke off.
"Think what?"
I bent and kissed his chest, arching my back to encourage him to rub it, which he did.
"Well, I'm no so sure I can explain, but it struck me that now I've lived longer than my father did, which is not something I expected to happen,"
he added with faint wryness.
"It's only... well, it seems odd is all. I only wondered, did you ever think of that yourself? Having lost your mother young, I mean."
"Yes." My face was buried in his chest, my voice muffled in the folds of his shirt. "I used to, when I was younger. Like going on a journey without a map." His hand on my back paused for a moment.
"Aye, that's it."
He sounded a little surprised.
"I kent more or less what it would be like to be a man of 30 or of 40. But now what?"
His chest moved briefly with a small noise that might have been a mixture of amusement and puzzlement.
"You invent yourself," I said softly to the shadows inside the hair that had fallen over my face. "You look at other women, or men. You try on their lives for size. You take what you can use, and you look inside yourself for what you can't find elsewhere. And always, always, you wonder if you're doing it right."
His hand was warm and heavy on my back. He felt the tears that ran unexpectedly from the corners of my eyes to dampen his shirt, and his other hand came up to touch my head and smooth my hair.
"Aye, that's it,"
he said again, very softly.
The camp was beginning to stir outside with clangings and thumps and the hoarse sound of sleep-rough voices. Overhead the grasshopper began to chirp, the sound like someone scratching a nail on a copper pot.
"This is a morning my father never saw,"
Jamie said, still so softly that I heard it as much through the walls of his chest as with my ears.
"The world and each day in it is a gift, Mukria, no matter what tomorrow may be."
I sighed deeply and turned my head to rest my cheek against his chest. He reached over gently and wiped my nose with a fold of his shirt.
"And as for taking stock," he added practically, "I've all my teeth,
None of my parts are missing, and my cock still stands up by itself in the morning. It could be worse.